Have you ever stopped to wonder what exactly success means to you? Is it money, fame, power, all of the above, or none at all? I'm Darshan Johan, and this is Redefining Success, a show where we speak to passionate people from various fields about their lives, what makes them tick, and what the word success means to them. Joining me on the show today is a film critic and a teacher, Samuel Lim. Welcome to the show, Sam. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Before we get into your idea of success, Sam, talk to me a little bit about the work that you do.
Well, before I became a full-time master's in an English language studies course in UM, I was a film critic for Laviat, namely two publications that actually you ran. You ran one of them, Movie Dash, and another one is currently Hype Malaysia. I mostly critique films, write articles about them, give my own personal opinions, and perhaps a layered commentary on how society has come to understand the superhero phenomenon and current pop culture. And then I teach kids how to spell. It's my day job. To varied success. I still remember this one kid. I've learned to pace myself on what I define success as. So I understand that there are just some children who will never be able to spell caterpillar. And
right.
I have to make peace with that. So yeah.
Now, when you think of the word success, Sam, what does that mean to you?
Okay, so I'll give you my personal definition of success. Then I'll tell you what I currently see a lot of Gen Z and Gen Yers think of success.
Right. Whatever. Okay.
Yeah. So my personal definition for success is just three things. One, it's financial sufficiency. You obviously have to be well compensated for the job you have to a certain livable wage in which you can support yourself. And, you know, if you have various responsibilities, I think it varies from person to person. So if you're able to be sufficient to support your needs and the obligations of your family, because I do know some people who do have relatives or family members who do need that sort of financial support. Healthy productivity, because I do see that a lot of people tie their identity to their productivity, and that creates toxic productivity where they feel like they are not measuring up, and it hurts their self-esteem, and they go to a company and they feel like they're not performing, and the bosses or the employers don't give them a healthy metric for what progress looks like. So they're caught in this vicious cycle of self-loathing, at the same time self-motivation. So if you can sort of have that verifiable and quantifiable metric for what productivity is, for example, you can say, I can see myself in a year reaching a certain goal. I can see myself progressing and getting better at my competency levels in a job. Then that's healthy productivity that doesn't really hurt my work-life balance. And finally, workplace autonomy. I should be able to feel comfortable enough to approach my boss and my coworkers to have a conversation about them, about the working condition, about the way we're running things, and about the way the product is created. So yeah, I think these three things are very crucial to what I define as success in the workplace.
So you said that, you know, Gen Y and many people of Gen Y and Gen Z sort of have a very different way of defining success. Based on your observation, how do many people define success?
Oh, we need to talk briefly about hustle culture, especially in Asia. It's insane because a lot of people, at least from what I observe within certain male communities and certain female communities, have been taking up terms like, I need to girl boss my way through something. If I'm not getting the recognition and the pay or the respect I deserve, it's not because there's something wrong with my working condition. It's because I need to just work extra hard. I need to grind it out. I need to do the weekends. If my boss asked me to work on certain weekends, then that's a sign of success. That's a sign that he trusts me. It's a sign that I'm showing initiative. And in time, I will be rewarded with that. So a lot of people define what they view as success as, well, earning the big bucks, obviously. But another way that I find it a little problematic is in the way on how hard they're working. Because if you look at people, they won't feel comfortable saying, you know what? I have a comfortable job. I can have a proper work-life balance. I define myself as successful. No. People I find these days are constantly obsessed with productivity, especially when you look at modern gurus like Gary Vee and Andrew Tate, who are constantly pushing hustle culture, who are constantly pushing the idea that if you're not thinking about money, you're not thinking about maximizing profit, you're not reading 3 books a day, you're not reaching a certain level of success. But I don't think that's completely true. So yeah.
Why do you think that approach is not something that, why doesn't that approach to success or that philosophy of success sit right with you?
My logic when it comes to how humans should view their needs is, well, it's mostly based on Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Right.
It starts from physiological, then it goes to social, then it goes to self-actualization. So I feel like if you're constantly caught in that rat race, you martyr your ability to have meaningful social relationships with people. And when you do that, is that really a success? I don't think so. And it's almost a trope at this point to hear about the father who overworks and the son who grows up going like, my dad loved my work more than I do. But then we always see at the end, the redeeming factor, the father said, I did it for you and now you can have a comfortable life. And the son is like, wow, now I understand that. Nobody stops to say, why is that sacrifice necessary?
Right.
Why should he have to, you know, essentially give up a big part of his life as a father or as a son or as somebody just so that he can attain financial stability?
Sam, has your definition of success changed over time?
I won't lie. I used to be a hustle bro. I used to hear a lot of stuff about, oh, you know, cryptocurrency is on the come up. You got to invest now. You got to go into stocks. You got to watch American Psycho. You got to read a Tony Robbins book. And I used to think that I need to attain a certain pay at a certain age. I need to be able to pursue higher education. I need to be able to have a clear path to management in the corporate ladder. And right now, after reaching to a certain level, that managerial position, I became deeply disillusioned with that. I thought to myself, you know, this isn't making me happy. And again, when I was working with certain institutions or companies, I realized how dehumanizing the process of certain managerial positions were to employees under them. And it didn't make me feel good, you know. To a certain degree, I did attain the things I did want, but it came at the expense of a lot of my personal and relational beliefs. So,
right.
Yeah. And I think now these days, it's so important that we don't martyr that for the sake of money. Again, I am religious. I am a Christian. Right. So growing up, we always heard money is the root of all evil. So that did sort of compel me to realize that if I am behaving in a way that marginalizes people, I cannot define that as success. If I can find a way that can help me create a product that I am deeply connected to, because I remember Karl Marx did talk about how alienation comes from the fact that workers are disengaged with your product. I'm just right. making the product. I don't own the means of production. I don't feel engaged with the work I'm doing. So if I'm doing work that I'm engaged with, that I'm fairly compensated with, and I can go home and say I've contributed something meaningful to my industry, I think that's a win.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Sam, why did you decide to become a writer? Let's talk about the writing aspect before we go to the teaching aspect.
Yeah, sure.
Why did you decide to become a writer and especially do something that's very niche, especially when we look at, like, you know, in Malaysia, for example, something such as film criticism?
For the longest time, at least growing up, film has always been a sort of pseudo-spiritual experience for me. And I love it because it's an invitation to experience another life and world through the perspective of characters. Yeah, there's some days you just want to pop on Hangover, Pacific Rim for a hoot, and then there are some cinematic experiences that stay with you. And to quote Samwise Gamgee, those were the stories that stay with you.
Right.
That meant something, even if you were too small to understand why. And as I grew older and I start watching films like Alien, Godfather, Goodfellas, Lord of the Rings, Nolan films, especially Nolan films. I think they play a big influence.
Right.
It began to awaken this sort of almost new eyes in me about the way I approach film and TV and visual audio media, because it made me think, if we can do so much to recreate an experience so real to life, that speaks volumes about how far we can go artistically. And I want to be part of that process. I want to be part of a medium that makes people feel in deeper ways and, you know, in that sense, engage with an art form that feels almost mythical at this point.
Right.
So to be able to contribute in my very minimal way to existing literature of an art form I care so deeply about, and to have my name on a byline, because I'm vain, is immensely gratifying. And it's just not about, because it feels like I'm not just another cog pushing out an ad or a spreadsheet. For better or for worse, it's my product. And even when I'm finished writing the article, people are still talking about the product. People are still engaging with the product. People are still having conversations about it. And for better or for worse, I find that deeply meaningful. So, yeah.
So why not pursue the realm of whether it's film criticism or just, you know, perhaps film journalism, you know, even more broadly, or just writing in general, writing for a publication? Why not do that full time? Why did you decide to pursue teaching as well?
Yeah, I get that question a lot, especially at family reunions. I think one of the reasons was because I realized that, especially in the publication industry, I do love what I do, but I don't think I could possibly do it full time, because I don't think that promotes a very healthy work-life balance. I can't wake up at 3 a.m. to watch a House of the Dragon trailer and get on it. And a lot of the major releases are all released at very odd hours of the day. You have to be prepared mentally, and you have to also be able to juggle your commute to work, your ability to keep on top of things and the pulse. And, you know, even during holiday seasons, you are not spared, because who knows? Disney Plus might release a Christmas special. And guess what? You don't get to have turkey this year, because, you know, you have to watch the Andor special or something. So, yeah, I didn't feel like that was feasible at the time. And, you know, for the longest time, I've always had good teachers. You know, I've always had very good teachers, and I've had such wonderful experiences. Whether it was my biology or off-tangent philosophy teacher, Miss Annie Koo, or my literature tutor, Mr. Chin San Sui, who's still doing performing arts even at this age. It's amazing. And yeah, my Marxist kooky social theory lecturer, Miss Natasha, they've all played an immensely important role in shaping who I am today. And they took the time to sow into my life, and it never felt like them in certain moments, like they were simply fulfilling a function or getting a paycheck. When I was with them, it never felt like they were just, you know, oh, I'm just doing this job and I guess I just have to do this sort of additional role as a counselor. I genuinely want to be invested in this child's life. And I wanted to see if I'd be able to do that and to be able to feel that immensely about my ability to connect to children and to my students. So going back to Marx's description of alienation, I feel like if done properly, teachers should never feel alienated from their work, because we're constantly being confronted with, for lack of a better word, the client's humanity. And our actions play a major role in shaping the lives of the next generation.
Now, Sam, I'm wondering, how important is passion when it comes to your career? When it comes to whatever choices you make in your career, is passion necessary when it comes to whatever work that you do? Or is it something where you can say, okay, I can just do something, you know, anything to make some money and then pursue my passions on the side?
Ooh, yeah, that's a question that I feel like a lot of us are going to have to reckon with at some point.
Right.
And I think a more idealized version of me would say, absolutely, yes, passion all the way. You can't have a job. If you love what you do, you never work a day in your life. I've heard... it's on every Facebook auntie's post.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, and I've come to realize competency should be the defining factor before you move into passion. Because if you're really good at your job, whether it's simple or not, and you can find a place for upward mobility, and you can find a community where you can have solidarity and meaningful friendships with, then passion comes eventually, you know? Right. When I became a teacher, I wasn't exactly like gung-ho for teaching kids. I mean, I saw it as an alternative because I'm like, ugh. And I felt like a failure. I was like, you know what? This is my life now. I'm a failed journalist who's going to go be a teacher. But after a while, I've come to realize that through me getting better at my job, it makes you think. It makes you, for lack of a better word, motivated and passionate to look for avenues to improve your craft. And I think if you're able to increase your competency, and there's a sort of way you can measure your competency and productivity, there's always going, there's eventual passion.
On the show with me today is Samuel Lim, who's a film critic and a teacher. After the break, I ask him how he measures growth. Keep it here on Redefining Success, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Redefining Success. I'm Darshan Johan, and on the show with me today is Samuel Lim, who's a film critic and a teacher. So, Samuel, how were you during your schooling days? Did you get good grades? What were your interests and ambitions back then? Have they changed over time?
I was not a good student back in my schooling days, like, because, again, I think the Malaysian education system has some flaws when it comes to the way we categorize students' ability to pick viable career paths, because I was not a good student, because right after my PMR, I scored 6 A's, and I was fed this promise by my parents, you do well in life, you can do whatever you want. You do well in life, you can do whatever you want. You'd have connections and you'd have the means to do it. So I got 6 A's, 1 B, and I thought, okay, great. I want to pursue art stream. And my school told me, no, you can't. What are you doing? Why are you throwing your life away? I'm like, wait, what? But you told me I could. That's the whole point of the grades. What? Now you're telling me I can't? And they were like, no lah, it's just, they're not for smart people. Huh? But I want to do it. And I like to think I'm relatively smart. Then eventually I got fed into science stream and I failed quite a number of subjects. I wasn't great at chemistry. I wasn't great at physics. I wasn't great at biology. And I grew up with very low self-esteem during my time in Form 4 and Form 5 because I kept thinking to myself, why am I here? I don't even like differentiation. I don't even know how momentum works.
Right.
So yeah, but eventually... I'm happy to report I am doing better now in my master's, much better. And it affirmed me that my measure of grades was in the past, in that sort of system that was so broad and so skewed towards STEM subjects to meet an artificial quota that it was wrong of me to define myself by faulty metric. So yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what drives you to keep doing what you're doing? Because, you know, you're a writer, you're a teacher, now you're pursuing your master's full time. Mm-hmm. What drives you to keep pushing?
What drives me to keep pushing is to believe that at some point I can own a house. Joking. Yeah.
That's the problem many of us face, to be honest. Yeah.
Yeah, that is true. Property is the lifelong goal of Gen Z. Yeah, I guess what drives me to keep doing what I'm doing is to believe that eventually the work I do will impact another person and will matter. You know, it used to be I need to earn a certain salary to feel like a success at this point. But right now, even as I'm doing my master's, and I know it's kind of corny, but I remember I had this conversation with a friend in uni, and he said, right, oh, so you're going back to be a teacher, but now with your master's, we have so much opportunities and all this. Don't you think you should try pursuing other things? And I think to myself, no, I don't want to do that. I love teaching, and I want to be there for my kids all the way until they graduate. And you know, obviously with fair compensation and a reasonable increment, but you know, I think when you put a human factor behind, or a creative factor, in fact, behind why you're doing something, and you decide that this is a personal project or a personal mandate I want to see through, I want to see my kids graduate. The class I started with, I want to see them graduate. I want to see them grow. I want to experience their childhood and be there with them and to watch them grow into, you know, respectable and functional adults. So yeah, I think if all I ever am is to be an English teacher, and all I ever will be is just to be there for somebody's period of life, I can live with that. I can see myself doing that for the rest of my life. And when you come to that sort of place where you can make peace with, I guess this is all I'll ever do in life, and I couldn't be happier, then I think you've made it. So yeah, to a certain degree, I think that's what drives me. To know that even if I get promotions, or even if I stay where I am, I can be happy. And that's the kind of place where I've set up, that's sort of, for lack of a better word, my purpose in life. So yeah.
What are some of the biggest lessons you've learned from your students? And I'm very interested because you are teaching very young kids. Have you learned anything from them?
I've actually learned a lot of lessons from them. From one, I've come to realize, because I do have students that confide in me about their home life and about how they are. And it's come to me that their childhood is immensely important to them, and acknowledging their emotional needs and their social needs as children are immensely important. Because I have children who do act out in school. I remember there's this one time, right? There was this child who was throwing things and was hurting people. And I told him, like, and I pulled him to the side. I told him, why are you behaving like this? And he told me, right, you know, I don't know. And then he was angry. Then after a while, I said, look, I'm not going to scold you. I just want you to tell me why you're behaving like this, okay?
Right.
Because you know you're not being cool. You know, you're not making friends like this. So why are you doing it? He's like, then he told me about his difficult home life, about his parents, about how they're not exactly doing well. And I told them, listen, I know I can't fix that. I can't fix that. But I want you to know that while you're here, if you do want to talk about it, or if you do want to, if you ever feel like you need to release that sort of pressure, you can always just go to a school counselor. You can always come to me and we can just have a discussion about it and talk about ways you can channel your focus into somewhere that's a bit more healthy and productive. And yeah, it taught me that not everything is motivated by children. Children don't exist in a vacuum, right. which I think a lot of teachers, especially in public schools, need to learn. Children don't exist in a vacuum. They are built by experiences, by home life, by their socioeconomic position. And I guarantee you, children who are brought up in disproportionately in poorer homes and with parents who don't have enough time for them will most likely fall by the wayside and become deeply problematic and antisocial at some point. So it's important to engage with children, and if you can, not obviously overtly, as the child feels more comfortable, to sort of look into their home life, to look into their social and mental well-being, and to see how they're doing. And I remember there's this one particular boy who's been called stupid a lot. Like, his brother always calls him stupid at home, and I didn't know. And I remember, right, this one time he was acting in class for English, and he just yelled, it's like, I don't want to do this anymore. I can't do it. And then he just flipped his table. I've never seen it before. A child actually flipped his table. And then he went out of class. I went, hey, what are you doing? And I was like, then I was going like, hey, buddy, what's going on? You flipped the table, literally. And he was like, I just don't feel like I'm good enough and I'll never be good enough. I'm like, hey, you are good enough. You want to know why? Because I'm your teacher. Am I a bad teacher? No. Then you're not a bad student. Let's make right. this work. Okay, obviously, that was not the best line to hinge his self-esteem on my ability. But I like to think the core principle makes sense that you tell children, you know, if you're not great at something, don't hinge your entire self-esteem on it. Let's work it out together. It's a cooperative process.
Right.
It's not just me talking down to you and you performing in an individual way. It's a collaborative process. And I need to be sensitive to your needs, to your experiences, to your traumas, and even to your certain learning disabilities, and to accommodate for them. Is it easy? No, definitely not. But I think in time, it is possible to do that in a large classroom setting. So yeah.
Yeah. So what are some of the biggest challenges you faced, be it when it comes to your career or otherwise, when it comes to attaining your definition of success?
I think one of the biggest challenges is just the way inflation has been going and the economic state of the world. Because currently I can say that with my current trajectory in work, I'm quite happy with it. Things have been going well.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say as we become a little bit more, as things become more expensive and the cost of living is rising and the idea of a livable wage seems like a more fanciful notion as time goes on and side hustles start to accumulate, I worry that I may not have enough. And that's always a crippling fear that nags at the back of my mind. And that is a major challenge I need to overcome. I need to tell myself it's all right for now if I don't exactly make it. It's all right if I don't exactly move out of my parents' house into a luxury condo. I just need to be able to think about easy and attainable steps and move towards it. So yeah, I think with the way things are functioning in Malaysia and with the rest of the world, especially in the wake of the pandemic and the Ukrainian war and food security, It's a scary time to be a adult. It's a scary time to be a worker. And yeah, that's something that I probably have to reckon with, like, with the reality that our world is currently boiling. Because in Europe, it's boiling over there and I'm scared that we may be swallowed up by the ocean. So,
right.
Yeah.
And, you know, just a follow-up question to that. You talk about, you know, how your perspective of success has changed over time. And then on the other side, right, you have the idea of success that doesn't necessarily sit right with you. You talk about hustle culture and this, you know, obsession with the rat race and you know, going, doing anything, you know, where, even if it means, you know, stepping on top of your colleagues and so on and so forth, you know, for the pursue of growth of money and things like that. And then you also talk about the realities of the world. You know, things are getting more expensive, inflation, and, you know, it's not just happening in one country, it's happening in many countries around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Have there been moments where you think to yourself, I don't think I can do this anymore? Have you ever reached a point where you're like, you know, looking at the realities of the world, I might just need to ditch all of this and go into, you know, the rat race, something that you may not be very passionate about and enthused about because you need to survive?
That has crossed my mind, and thank you for that question. Yeah, it probably has. I mean, there are some days where I look at my friends and I see that they are a little farther in life, financially and in terms with their career-wise, and I think, oh man, perhaps I picked the wrong field. Perhaps I should have joined that. But at the end of the day, I don't think so. I don't think I necessarily have to give that up. And if I do enter a corporate structure and I feel like, and push comes to shove, because you did ask, right? Do I feel like I have to give up and just go into the corporate structure and join a rat race? I think that if I ever do enter into a corporate structure, no matter what, I refuse to martyr my my beliefs and my personal convictions, because I have tried this process, because I have been in situations where companies have been difficult to me and have not exactly been good at staff. And one thing I realized is this: the most powerful key to improving workplace condition, whether you're in corporation, in schools or whatever, is to be kind, because kindness really does radicalize. Because I remember there's this one time there was a new worker who wasn't doing so well, wasn't performing, and everyone was just piling things on them and just telling them that, you know, why did you even come here? You're not very good. But I just decided to be kind, and I just decided to tell them, you know, I'm going to help you out in whatever way I am, whatever way I can. I'm going to go out to lunch with you. I'm going to go through this with you. And they asked, why would you do that? And I told them, because you and I, we have solidarity. You are me. We are both workers. We need to stop looking at this sort of we need to stop looking at our careers in this sort of way where it's a competitive cutthroat. And we need to start building solidarity in the workplace. And the only way we can do that is when we break the lie that I can only succeed by stepping on other people. And guess what? When he did that, he started forming meaningful relationships with new workers as well. We started creating more change in the department. And together as a collective, we started being healthier. We started befriending the mid-management. We started having real relationships with them. And then when mid-management comes, and instead of, you know, pushing an agenda that upper management pulls, when he sees us and he knows us and we care about them and he cares about us, he'll say, I need to renegotiate. I need to talk about this. I need to think twice before I put somebody in a difficult position. And I've seen it before. I've seen what happens when you push somebody with radical kindness. And eventually, I did see genuine change. I did see wages increase. I did see people stand up for people who weren't getting their fair compensation. So I believe that, will I in time eventually go into a corporate structure? Perhaps, maybe. But I'm never going to stop believing that if I am just kind and I don't use people as a stepping stone towards my success, and I genuinely see them as a human being, and I adopt this sort of Kantian principle to how I view people as an ends in themselves, not a means to an end, it radicalizes them. And I hope that they just continue to radicalize others. I'm not breaking down walls. I'm not burning corporations. I'm just being nice to people. I'm just telling people that I'm going to just be radically human to you. And I hope that through this, we can begin to acknowledge how some systems are deeply inhumane. So, yeah.
Definitely. What has been your proudest moment so far when it comes to your career?
I think one of my proudest moments was finally being able to be paid for the works I was writing, and to finally, because I remember back then you picked up my review on Captain America Civil War, and you told me, right, hey, do you want to try this platform? We you write well, we'd like to see you try. And, you know, I think you were very radically human towards me, and it taught me that I can do this. I can sort of like have creative autonomy, and I can have a good workplace structure that teaches me how to grow and teaches me to still be myself. And yeah, that was one of my proudest moments, the moment that I could get an actual article published. And I think another proudest moment for me is, well, my first Teacher's Day, obviously. I remember one of my students came up to me and I was like, teacher, I didn't used to read, but now because of you, I like to read and I like to learn.
That's awesome.
Like, yeah. I was like, I made a change. I did a Dead Poet Society. And they're like, oh, and my heart just grew like two times that day. And then like, I was so arrogant. I kicked down the doors like, I'm the best teacher in the world. And I saw every other teacher there. It's like, yeah, we know. All our kids said that. They're like, oh, really? Yeah, yeah. You get that high during Teacher's Day. But, you know, after that, it's back to dealing with them. So enjoy it. I was like, oh, Okay. And over the years, I won't say I've become cynical or hardened towards Teacher's Day, but I do realize, I'm like, oh, this is really sweet. But nothing beats the first time a student genuinely comes to you and says, you know, teacher, I think I've become better at this because of you. And I think one of them told me, right, I think you're like my big brother. And I was like, oh, do not. And I reacted with that with such, like, in a really strange masculine way. I was like, don't say that to me. Don't say that to me. Then I went to the bathroom. I was like, okay, I guess I matter to them. And I'm like, okay, children, it's time to watch Avatar The Last Airbender while I compose myself in the corner. So, yeah.
Sam, how do you measure growth? And does money factor into the way you measure growth?
Oh, yeah. I think at this point, you have to factor in money. Obviously, I think I have to talk about whether it is a livable wage. Am I going to be able to meet my goals, which is home ownership? I think a healthy goal that everyone should have is home ownership. Right. That is the one we can go farthest with. I mean, obviously, if you have additional things like debt, medical expenses, yes, look for that. But I think what money does is it provides us a way to see the needs we can meet and how we can meet other needs as well. For example, if somebody is working just to survive, just to be able to eat and pay rent, I wouldn't say you're in a very healthy place now. But if you can grow to suddenly say, hey, I can now afford to invest, I can now in property, I can now afford to take care about the people I love, I can now afford to support other people, then I think that's a healthy metric for growth. Money, when it's seen as a way that you can sort of expand your relational circle, is a way you can measure growth. Because if I can afford now, not only just to take care of myself, but my family, and I can then support, I can then be part of social communities and clubs and hobbies and interests that I would have otherwise not been able to do unless I had money and connection to, then I think that is a way we can view it. Right. That's how far will your circle of connections stretch? So yeah, I think that is a metric. Another way I measure growth is, are you getting better at managing your sleep cycle, your ability to do the things you want to do? Because outside of work, right, you need personal growth.
Yep.
Whether it's time at the temple or the mosque or at the church, or whether it's just time to read a book you really want to enjoy, leisure, I think people need to start looking as a form of personal growth. If I can now have time for leisurely activity and not feel guilt about it, I think that's a sign of growth. And as I progress farther in my career and I find that I can have a healthier work-life balance, that's definitely a sign of growth. So, yeah.
Absolutely. One final question before we wrap this conversation up. At the start of the show, you defined what success is to you. Do you feel where you are right now that you have attained your definition of success?
Well, obviously, I think, you know, as time goes on, conditions can obviously be refined and people can work to better their environment in the workplace. But currently, I think I do have a very healthy view on productivity now. I don't tie my intrinsic identity to my work, and I can see that I am genuinely working towards a goal that is existing. In both my jobs currently, because I am studying, so I am doing private tutoring before I enter back into full-time teaching, and with my current writing with Lao Yat, I do feel like I have enough personal autonomy where I can have a say, where I own the means of production, where I can engage. So I'd say that too. And I think in terms of financial sufficiency, yeah, I should be able to support myself at least until I finish my master's and go into full-time teaching. So yeah, I think that's, if anyone takes away from this, I feel like these three goals and these three sort of ways of measuring are relatively healthy. So yeah, I think in that sense, I am successful.
Absolutely. And on that note, thank you so much for joining me today, Sam.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
That was Samuel Lim. He's a film critic and a teacher. If you'd like to read his movie reviews, you can check out hype.my. If you missed any part of our conversation today, you can also check us out on podcasts. We're available on the BFM app, bfm.my, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Darshan Johan, and this has been Redefining Success, BFM 89.9.